Welcome to SNC's podcast series, SNC Critical Insights. I'm Andrew DeFilippis, and I'm a special counsel in SNC's litigation group and national security practice. I came back to SNC about a year and a half ago after spending 9 years at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, and I previously worked as counselor to the U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security. Let me just briefly introduce our panelists today, all of whom are members of our new national security practice. First, we have Sharon Cohen-Levin, who is a leading expert on anti-money laundering, Bank Secrecy Act, and forfeiture matters, and is co-head of our national security practice. She previously led the money laundering and asset forfeiture unit in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York for 20 years. Tony Lewis is also co-head of our national security practice and co-head of our cybersecurity practice. Tony joined the firm after 10 years at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Central District of California, where he served as deputy chief of the Terrorism and Export Crime Section. Eric Cadell is co-head of the firm's foreign investment and trade regulation practice and its economic sanctions and financial crime groups. He's an expert and a distinguished practitioner in the areas of sanctions, export controls, FCPA, and the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS. He's been an SNC partner for more than 15 years and previously clerked for the US Supreme Court. Finally, Adam Zubin is of counsel and a member of the firm's financial services group and national security practice. Adam has had a distinguished career in national security as well before coming to Sullivan and Cromwell. Adam was at the Treasury Department for nearly 13 years, including as the director of OFAC and as acting undersecretary for terrorism and financial intelligence. So that's our panel. Today, we wanted to focus on some recent developments out of the enforcement agencies, the common theme of which is that the DOJ and other law enforcement and regulatory agencies increasingly view corporate America, including financial institutions, as having a role to play in protecting national security. And that's especially true in the area of sanctions and export controls. These developments that we're going to cover demonstrate that agencies are focused on establishing enhanced rewards and incentives, but also stiffer penalties that encourage companies to act in line with U.S. national security interests. So the three areas or developments that we were going to briefly cover today. First is a July 2023 Tri-Seal compliance note that was issued by the DOJ, the Commerce Department, and the Treasury Department, clarifying those agencies' voluntary self-disclosure programs. The second is another Tri-Seal compliance note issued in March of 2024, and that emphasizes the obligations of foreign-based persons to comply with U.S. sanctions and export control laws. And then finally, we're going to spend just a little time talking about some recent announcements and expansions in the U.S. government's whistleblower programs. So, starting with the July 2023 compliance notes, I thought we'd start, Tony, with you and just ask you, what were the highlights of that note and what is it that folks should take away from what was laid out there?
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. So in July of 2023, DOJ, Commerce, and Treasury issued the Tri-Seal compliance note. It describes updates and clarifications to those agencies' voluntary self-disclosure programs. Overall, the note underscores a persistent message to incentivize corporations to make voluntary self-disclosures, or VSDs. But there are a few points worth calling attention to in this context. First, it reflects greater enforcement focus on sanctions and export controls, and that the agencies responsible for that enforcement are coordinating with each other. Second, there are still distinctions between how those agencies treat voluntary disclosures. For example, DOJ's National Security Division's policy does not recognize a self-report to another agency like to OFAC or BIS, while OFACs may. And different agencies use slightly different standards to evaluate whether a self-disclosure qualifies for credit as a VSD.
Thanks, Tony. Before we go into some of the specific provisions of the memo, I just wanted to pose a general question to the group, which is, does the agency's current approach, which involves mitigation of penalties based on self-disclosure, actually encourage more disclosures and cooperation by companies? And in particular, just give us a sense, I'm looking for a sense of what is the typical business's risk calculus in terms of whether to disclose a national security violation and how that might be different for companies versus financial institutions. Adam, maybe starting with you, what thoughts do you have on that?
Sure, and thanks for the question, Andrew. So, I mean, I think financial institutions are really used to the world of self-disclosures. There's a number of reasons for that. One is they are examined entities. So they've got supervisors coming in and going through their books and transactions and checking to see whether they've caught all the mistakes and disclosed as they should. So it's really not much of a debate whether a financial institution is going to self-disclose a material violation that they encounter. For companies that aren't regulated in the same way, that don't have on-site supervisors, it's a different calculus, of course, and they may, in many cases, not even detect something as readily as a financial institution would. But should they detect it, it then becomes a strategic question of, do you disclose or not? And I would say in my experience, the best practice is to disclose, both because of the better treatment that you get, as you were outlining and as Tony mentioned, also because any transaction, investment, trade will typically have a number of other parties involved who may have their own incentives to go to OFAC and to disclose it, and in particular, as we were saying, banks. So if you believe the transaction is already going to come to the government's attention, it is definitely in your interest to come forward and disclose.
Thanks, Adam. And looking to from an OFAC perspective to a DOJ perspective, Sharon, I'd imagine the calculus might differ a little bit when the violation is a potential criminal violation as opposed to an OFAC regulatory violation, which is civil. What thoughts do you have on how they differ or are similar?
Well, I think you're right, Andrew. There is a different calculus when it's the question of whether or not to disclose to the Department of Justice. Deciding whether to disclose to DOJ a potential criminal violation is going to be a more difficult question because of the risks are greater, not just in terms of criminal prosecution and any collateral consequences that will arise from that, but also the reputational harm to a company. While there are substantial concrete benefits to voluntary self-disclosure, companies often grapple with whether it's worth disclosing if the activity is unlikely to be discovered by the Department of Justice or other law enforcement authorities. It's often easier to decide to self-disclose when there's an industry-wide practice that's under investigation and it's known that the Department of Justice is investigating those activities.
Thanks, Sharon. And Eric, you do extensive work in the area of CFIUS, also OFAC, licensing for OFAC regulations. What perspective does that give you on how particular companies who may deal with CFIUS view these issues?
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. I'm not sure that there's anything really specific to the practice that deals with voluntary disclosures per se, but one thing that I think is really important to understand in this area is that there has been absolutely a very focused effort and resources provided to the effort for the government to obtain information through other channels. And that is something that you really have to factor in when you're considering whether or not to make a voluntary disclosure, because the benefits of the voluntary disclosure, as you pointed out, are significant. But not making a voluntary disclosure, the chances that your conduct is not going to be discovered otherwise are diminishing. And just to illustrate a little bit there, I mean, CFIUS in the legislation that reformed CFIUS in the last part of the Trump administration, there was an office established within CFIUS to specifically go out and find non-notified transactions. And CFIUS will much more frequently go out to parties that did not file and require them to come in and explain the situation and potentially make a filing. It's a little different than a voluntary disclosure question, right? But CFIUS filings are often voluntary as opposed to mandatory. And where people are choosing not to voluntarily file, there is a greater possibility that CFIUS will come back, find out about the transaction on its own, and come ask the parties questions about the transaction. So it is a factor that I think you need to, and parties need to consider.
Got it. And going back to the provisions in this March 2023 compliance note, it lays out how when a company voluntarily self-discloses a violation, fully cooperates, and then remediates any deficiencies, the National Security Division will not seek a guilty plea. And in fact, it'll apply a presumption of a non-prosecution agreement carrying no fine. So for our devoted listeners who listened to our first podcast, Tony had noted in that session that this was not actually a significant departure from how the Philip factors are applied at DOJ. There were some issues that are distinctly related to national security in the revised policy. For example, it takes into account whether the conduct posed a grave threat to national security, involves sensitive technology, whether there are prior violations, and it specifically includes administrative violations like OFAC or BIS violations. But as Tony pointed out, it was really more of a clarification than an expansion or a change to existing DOJ voluntary self-disclosure policy. But again, I think we understand why the DOJ publicizes the benefits in the way that it did. As a quick side note, more recently, just a couple weeks ago on March 7th, the National Security Division again updated its voluntary disclosure policy. And I'll turn to Tony. Tony, what was the gist of that latest update?
Yeah, most of the latest changes relate to mergers and acquisitions. So when an acquiring company makes a qualifying VSD to the National Security Division that meets certain requirements, NSDU generally will not seek a guilty plea from the acquirer, and there's a presumption that NSD will decline to prosecute the acquirer. So under the policy, an acquirer that conducts due diligence and timely submits a VSD after the completion of a transaction may qualify for additional protections under this M&A policy. The acquirer can avail itself of those protections if, after it becomes aware of and discloses the potential criminal violations of U.S. export controls, sanctions, or other laws affecting U.S. national security by the acquired company, the acquirer does need to meet certain additional requirements, including, first, that it was a bona fide acquisition. Second, the acquirer voluntarily and timely self-disclosed. And third, that they fully cooperate with the DOJ's investigation.
Got it. And under the new policy, Tony, is there a particular time period that it lays out for what constitutes a timely disclosure?
Yes, here in this context, the policy specifies that a timely disclosure is generally within 180 days after the transaction closes, but that is limited to the M&A context.
The compliance note also mentions, quote, other offenses, including the Foreign Agents Registration Act or FARA, material support to a designated foreign terrorist organization, and CFIUS. I guess turning first to you, Eric, to what extent are those particular regimes likely to be a focus of future corporate criminal investigations?
Thank you, Andrew. So look, I think they are likely to be a focus. Remember in my previous discussion, I mentioned that many times a CFIUS filing is voluntary. Well, there is a class of filings that are required. And if the parties fail to make a filing, they are in breach of the law. Sometimes determining whether a filing is mandatory is difficult because it can turn on things that are very technical and detailed. So it's possible that the parties can violate the mandatory filing requirement without consciously doing so. They may just have gotten things wrong, but that's all going to be part of the renewed focus by CFIUS on looking at these non-notified transactions. In addition, in general, the possibility of CFIUS criminal or other regulatory inquiries can also relate to the failure to follow the terms of a national security agreement that has been signed in the context of obtaining a CFIUS approval in the first instance. What I mean by that is, in order to clear the CFIUS review and receive the so-called completion letter related to your transaction, you may need to enter into a national security agreement with CFIUS and particular agencies of CFIUS that will provide certain terms that you must follow in order to obtain the government's sign-off. And if you fail to follow those terms in the future, you are, again, in potentially in violation of law. And it's not so far been something that's been frequently attended to in the sense of a formal prosecution or charges. I mean, I think it comes up pretty regularly in the context of overall case monitoring, but it is not something where we've seen a history of prosecutions, regulatory enforcement on a public level, but I think that's going to change. As cases are discovered, whether through voluntary disclosure or not, I think we'll see a much greater activity in that area.
And next, turning to Sharon. Sharon, what about FARA? To what extent have we seen or should we expect to see FARA cases coming out of DOJ?
Thanks, Andrew. Well, FARA, or the Foreign Agents Registration Act, requires agents of foreign countries, political parties, and companies to register with the Department of Justice if they attempt to influence U.S. public opinion or lobby American officials for policy changes. And we haven't typically seen many FARA prosecutions. It's more commonly used as a predicate for intelligence collection and counterintelligence investigations than for criminal prosecutions. But recently, there has been a change, and we are seeing criminal prosecutions under FARA. The most recent example is a case against New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez. The indictment in that case contains really an unprecedented allegation. For the first time, or what I believe is the first time, a sitting member of Congress has been criminally charged with working as an agent of a foreign power. The bribery-focused indictment accuses the senator, his wife, and a business associate of conspiracy to have the senator act as a foreign agent of Egypt in violation of federal law. That is a significant criminal case, and we may expect to see more from the Department of Justice.
Great. Thanks, Sharon. So the compliance note that we've been discussing has three sections: Department of Justice, Commerce, and Treasury. Just to talk about Commerce, similar to the DOJ, they emphasize that a disclosure that's timely and comprehensive and involves full cooperation of the disclosing party substantially reduces the applicable civil penalty under the BIS settlement guidelines. So, Eric, how has that actually been applied in practice? Is there any noticeable change in recent Commerce cases, or is it too soon to say?
Yeah, Andrew, I think it is a little too soon to say anything definitively, but I would note that it's pretty clear that the Commerce Department is focused on voluntary self-disclosure, and that there's really, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's an expectation that parties make voluntary disclosure, but they're clearly encouraging that parties do so. And whether we see a significant uptick in disclosures because of this renewed focus or not. I think we still need to see that play out over time.
And Commerce in this memo also announced what they're calling a dual track system, which is where minor or technical violations are handled on a fast track basis with a warning or no action letter within 60 days. And then cases that Commerce determines are potentially more serious violations are going to get what they call a deeper dive. Any reactions, Eric, on how significant this announcement is?
I look at this one as a significant announcement as well, in the sense that it's, again, encouraging self-disclosure and providing a little bit of a carrot, again, especially in the situations where it's a minor or technical violation. Now, of course, whether something's a minor or technical violation is going to be in the eye of the beholder, but they're saying that in the event that they determine it is a minor or technical violation, then hopefully through practice and conferences and so forth, there'll be a better sense of how they're going to view a minor or technical violation. But to the extent that they see that, then they're letting the public know and regulated parties know, or parties subject to jurisdiction know, that they can come in and voluntarily disclose, and that it'll get handled quickly on a relatively pain-free basis. But even in the case where they're going to do a deeper dive for a potentially more serious violation, they're still encouraging voluntary disclosure and still offering the carrot by offering reduced penalties as opposed to a non-notified case.
And a few months before this compliance note, the Commerce Department actually clarified its risk calculus on disclosures and said that deliberate non-disclosure will be an aggravating factor, and that reporting another entity's violation of the EAR regulations, which are promulgated by Commerce, is a mitigating factor if information leads to an enforcement action, and the company can even benefit from reporting another company in a future unrelated action. Sharon, just looking at what Commerce has done there, are companies actually likely to report each other's violations? And what are the ways in which they're going to think about whether to do that?
I do think that it's very possible that companies will report on each other. This memo really could change the calculus for certain companies. These carrots and sticks are designed to do just that. All of the agencies are clearly signaling that there are very real penalties for companies who do not voluntarily self-disclose, and significant rewards for companies that report on export control violations, not just of themselves, but their competitors. The concept that a company that reports on a competitor can essentially bank its credit for use in a future investigation or a future violation creates a really interesting dynamic. And it's not so different than what happens in criminal cases in general, where defendants compete to be the first to cooperate in a criminal case in order to receive the significant benefits of cooperation.
Thanks. And just to follow up, Sharon, there's also been more detailed guidance in the form of alerts that we've seen from Commerce, BIS, and FinCEN about what might constitute a violation. How might that affect companies' views and decisions on these things?
Well, there's a lot more information out there, and there's a lot more eyes on conduct. The information that's put out in these joint alerts between Commerce, BIS, and FinCEN, particularly the red flags for export control violations, is information that banks or other financial institutions can use to determine whether to file suspicious activity reports or SARs. As a result, law enforcement is getting more information on export control violations, which can impact a decision of a company on whether or not to voluntarily self-disclose the violation. If the company chooses not to disclose the violation, they run the very real risk that the company's bank or its competitor may do so. The more that there is an ongoing and proactive exchange of information between regulatory authorities, law enforcement, and the private sector on these issues, the more individual companies will have an incentive to participate in that exchange.
Now, we're all familiar with various task forces and strike forces that the U.S. government has set up over the years. In 2023, the DOJ and BIS announced a disruptive technology strike force. Tony, has that been a strike force that actually has seen results or not?
Yeah, the Department of Justice issued a fact sheet in February of 2024 summarizing their results so far. It highlighted certain of the following prosecutions over the last year. There were 7 cases involving the export of microelectronics, UAV components, semiconductors, and other technology to Russia. 3 cases involving the theft of confidential and proprietary information and technology with intent to bring it to China. And note that more recently, in March of this year, DOJ arrested Lin Weiding, a Chinese national in California, on 4 counts of federal trade secret theft for allegedly seeking to bring confidential Google AI secrets to China. And 3 cases involving efforts to procure sensitive U.S. technology on behalf of the government of Iran or Iranian end users.
And I would just note before we move on, the Treasury part of the memo largely underscores the message that Commerce and DOJ conveyed in their portions, but noted that the potential for qualifying for a voluntary self-disclosure, that that can result in a 50% reduction in the base amount of a civil penalty. So again, each agency here really emphasizing the concrete benefits that a company can get for self-disclosure. Turning next to the March 2024 compliance note, this note really, by these 3 agencies, emphasizes the extraterritorial reach of U.S. sanctions and export control laws, and notes that those laws are applicable to persons and entities located abroad, and that these agencies intend to enforce violations that occur abroad in many cases. So the OFAC portion highlights some recent actions, including against Toll Holdings Limited, Alfa Laval Middle East, Wade Bank, and others. The first question, and maybe Adam, given your former role as head of OFAC, is, does this represent a change in OFAC in trying to make more overseas cases, or is it just essentially public relations?
To some extent, OFAC has for a long time been pursuing non-US companies for transactions that touch the United States. And that goes back to my time at OFAC when there were a series of what have been called the big bank cases. These were largely European banks transacting with U.S. sanctioned jurisdictions in U.S. dollars. So you had Barclays, Lloyds, UBS, Credit Suisse, and others who were transacting in dollars via U.S. correspondent accounts. That is a violation by a non-U.S. person, and that's something OFAC has deep experience with. So in one sense, this isn't new. But in another sense, I think OFAC is telegraphing here an intent to really focus its finite enforcement energies against foreign actors. And that's something you see across the agencies involved in this compliance note, because when it comes to Russia, the biggest threat when it comes to evasion or circumvention of what have been a kind of G7 sanctions effort has not been actors inside the United States or by and large actors inside the EU. It's often actors in places like Kazakhstan, places like Armenia, or you have individual actors in UAE, India, China, who are either routing US controlled goods or routing transactions in US dollars to Russia or on behalf of Russia. And I do think OFAC is serious here when it says that's going to be very high enforcement priority for them.
Thanks, Adam. And just turning briefly to the Commerce Department, as you noted, many international companies either ship goods to countries that may be subject to these regulations or have employees who live and work in those countries. Commerce, in their portion of this note, emphasized prohibitions against re-exports, in-country transfers, and then the what they call the de minimis thresholds and foreign direct products rule, which look at portions of goods that may be U.S. made. My question to you, Adam, is do these kinds of rules and actions from the Commerce Department actually deter companies that are dealing with Russia, China, and other sanctioned places?
I mean, yes, I think foreign companies that are importing U.S. controlled goods know they have to be careful not to sell them directly to prohibited countries. But what we've seen in the past is whether because their compliance regimes just can't see far enough, or whether because they may be willfully not looking, their goods are indeed going on to places like Russia. And there have been a number of studies recently that show Russian battlefield equipment being captured with US and EU controlled goods in them. So in a practical sense, Commerce, OFAC, DOJ are aware of this and are now looking to crack down. And I think companies are going to have to become more attuned to and more alert to the ultimate consumer, the ultimate recipient of the goods that they're exporting, which is going to produce a massive challenge and headache for them. Because you sell it on to somebody who sells it on to an import-export firm, how do you then ascertain where it's going? And this is something that not just the U.S. is focused on, but I know EU officials as well.
Thanks, Adam. And finally, on DOJ, Sharon, recent prosecutions from the DOJ really illustrate that in the national security area, DOJ continues to be focused on overseas activities that touch on Russia, China, Iran. And we've even seen them, the money laundering and asset forfeiture section and the National Security Division, pair up to investigate cases in the crypto space. To what extent do DOJ's recent prosecutions break new ground or advance existing legal theories in new areas? What are we seeing there?
Well, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York's indictment of the founders of Tornado Cash in 2023 reflect law enforcement's increased unease with anonymity-enhancing tools in the crypto space. Recent DOJ actions signal that prosecutors will continue to aggressively enforce the money transmitter registration requirements and the attendant Bank Secrecy Act anti-money laundering program requirements and the suspicious activity reporting obligations in the crypto space. This is likely to be a continuing area for criminal investigation and criminal prosecution.
Thanks. And in our last couple minutes, Sharon, just another issue for you. We've seen that there have been a few developments in the U.S. government's whistleblower programs, which seem to only add to the drumbeat of public messaging here about the need for cooperation and voluntary self-disclosure by companies and individuals in the national security space. What are some of the whistleblower-related developments we've seen?
Well, there's been a lot of activity in that area in the last year or so. First, FinCEN expanded its relatively new whistleblower program to cover not just violations stemming from the Bank Secrecy Act, but also from U.S. trade and economic sanctions. FinCEN may reward whistleblowers who provide information that enables the enforcement of a related action. This means that FinCEN may compensate individuals who disclose information with respect to enforcement actions that proceed under, for example, the Export Control Reform Act. So it's a much, much broader ability to obtain for whistleblowers to file claims with FinCEN and receive real financial compensation. Second, just recently, the Deputy Attorney General announced a DOJ whistleblower program to be designed by the Money Laundering and Asset Recovery Section, FBI, and U.S. Attorney's offices. This program will apply to any violations of federal law, but there's a special emphasis on criminal abuses of the U.S. financial system, foreign corruption cases that fall outside of the jurisdiction of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and the jurisdiction of the SEC, including FCPA violations by non-issuers and violations of the recently enacted Foreign Extortion Prevention Act and as well as domestic corruption cases, especially involving illegal corporate payments to government officials. And then finally, two U.S. attorneys' offices, the Southern District of New York and the Northern District of California, recently announced their own whistleblower pilot programs that are designed to encourage whistleblowing as well as to encourage voluntary self-disclosures. So on numerous levels, from multiple U.S. government departments, particularly Treasury, Justice, and Commerce, federal law enforcement and regulators are encouraging those into the private sector to raise their hands, report violations, and help federal authorities build cases and protect national security.
Thanks, Sharon. And I think that's all the time we have for today, but I want to give a big thanks to everyone for a very interesting discussion. Thank you to our listeners for listening to S&C Critical Insights. For more information about our practice, you can visit us on the web at www.solcrom.com.